That's my gig, right? That's my thing. How do I help them achieve their goal? It's not about not achieving your goal. It's not about somehow changing your drive and your ambition. It's about how do you do that and have an exquisite life?
Welcome to the Unstoppable Woman podcast, where we explore what it means to create a truly exquisite life. I'm your host, Amira Alvarez, inviting you to be part of these intimate conversations about feminine ambition, what lies beyond traditional notions of success, and how to answer the question, what's next when you've already achieved so much? Let's dive in.
Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Unstoppable Woman podcast. I'm Amira Alvarez. I'm your host here on the podcast and also the founder and CEO of the Unstoppable Woman. We are a global but boutique intimate coaching company that helps ultra successful women really claim and actualize an exquisite life in all areas of their life, not just in the wealth and business building sections of it. So we're going to have a new conversation today around success, ambition, one's power, and what it means to have an exquisite life with my guest here today, Maggie Adhami Boyton. She is the founder and CEO, or co-founder and CEO of ShopThing. And I'm going to let her introduce herself. And welcome to the program. Welcome to the podcast, Maggie. So good to have you here.
Thank you, Amira. So good to be here. I'm so excited to jump in. Before I do, I'll tell you a little bit about myself. My name is Maggie. I've been in tech my entire career. I'm not going to say how long because it's going to date me, but I've been in tech my entire career. I was working on the SaaS side, so building these incredible software programs for massive companies, when I came across this trend in Asia of live shopping, got completely obsessed. And truthfully, at the time, I mean, not at the time, still, fashion and style and retail were always my passion, but I had this like little blog and a very small micro following on Instagram. And I had this like light bulb moment where I realized I compare the thing that I love most in my life to the thing that I know best in my life, which is tech. And so ShopThing was born out of that. ShopThing is a live shopping marketplace. So think QVC, but instead of using hosts, we use influencers and it happens on mobile. So real-time shopping with people actually trying things on and demoing them and showing them to you. And it's a two-way type of shopping where you can ask questions. How does it fit? How does it feel? Yeah. So that's, in a nutshell, that's
okay. I love it. So this is going to, I'm going to go down so many different paths here because I claimed my inner fashionista. I don't even know what to call that later in life, like in my 40s. So my story is, I don't know, maybe you'll relate to this. Maybe it's totally different, but my story is that, you know, when I was a kid in the 80s, I'm going to date myself. I'll just be out there with everyone. I'm 53. Okay. That's my age. And when I was a kid in the 80s, I would get these catalogs in the mail. And one of them was the Esprit catalog. Do you remember Esprit? And they would have these outfits and there would be like 17 things as part of this outfit. And I would look at like the outfit and want it all. And I could buy, like, I had the money to buy one like scarf, right? You know, like I couldn't, there was like no way to have this full expression, right? This fashion. And I think from that point on, I had a hate love. Like I always wanted to look good, but I also felt like I didn't have the funds. I had to deny myself. I couldn't do it. And I came up with a lot of justification around it. Like, you know, it's better to spend money on travel or books or, you know, all these things. And I love travel and I love books, so I'm not dismissing those. But it wasn't until my 40s where I did this real deep dive into like full expression of who I was that I started to claim that I really love looking good and looking good in really pretty clothes. And so I've sort of slowed down recently, but
maybe after you download their app, you will pick back up.
it sounds kind of dangerous, actually. So, but also fun. I'm fascinated. So tell me, have you said fashion has always been a big key part, like from growing up? Tell me about that.
It's really interesting because I can't tell you how it started, but I absolutely can. My mother is a massive fashionista. Like, this is where I get it from. She is a big customer of ours and she just loves it. And so I think growing up, seeing her always put together. It didn't matter where we were going, whether it was a grocery store or an actual, you know, an event, she always looked incredible. So I guess early on, obviously that was an influence for me, but very quickly I realized that when I looked a certain way, like the way that I thought was great, I felt better. And so I tended to lean into that, right? So I would go out of my way to make sure, you know, that I always looked good, whatever that meant in my world at the time. It's changed many times over the X years that I've been alive, but clothing and my personal style always made me feel really good. And very similar to you, I didn't grow up with a ton of money. So it wasn't like I had all this money to spend on clothes. I actually always had a part-time job and I used all of my disposable income on clothing. Like that was what I did. And my mom would be like, why are you spending all your money on clothes? And I was like, because I love it and it makes me feel good. And she was sympathetic to that cause. And obviously later in life, I learned how to save and all that fun stuff. But that was what I did with my money. I didn't travel. I did read, but I didn't travel. I spent it all on things that I felt, you know, made me feel really, really good.
I have so many follow-up questions here. Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the subject of like clothes and fashion making you feel good. So there is the philosophy that nothing outside of yourself should affect how you feel. Like happiness comes from within, you know, good self-image, you'll be happy no matter what. Why do you need all this stuff, right? The minimalist, I am not a minimalist. I'm going to claim that right now. The minimalist says, you don't need this. This is capitalism. This is conditioning. This is materialism. This is how they keep you on the treadmill, right? You know, what is your perspective on that?
I obviously can't agree with that for many reasons. I've made a career out of what I loved and my passion, and style is one of them. What I would say to that is it is a form of self-expression. So it's not just about that material thing, and it doesn't have to be an expensive thing, but it was my way of self-expressing. So some people might have, you know, dyed their hair pink or got a ton of piercings or got tattoos or what have you. And that was their way of self-expressing and building their unique self. For me, it was clothing and style and fashion. And again, it didn't need to be, you know, outrageous or expensive. It just needed to be something that I felt like allowed me to tell the world who I was and who I was as a person, what my personality was like.
Okay, I love it. I love it. So today, I'm going to put you on the spot. For those of you who are watching on YouTube or in any place where there's video, you'll be able to see that she's wearing a very chic black shirt. And it looks, I can't tell because your hair is in front of it, but it looks like there might be a few little ruffles on it. Some style. Yeah. So what does this shirt express to you? Like, why did you pick this morning?
This is a great question. And interestingly enough, I didn't think about it when I bought it. I didn't think about it, you know, even today when I wore it. But as you're saying that, I have very, very tiny shoulders. And I tend to gravitate towards shoulder pads because they give me broad shoulders. It makes me feel a little bit more like present and there and confident and what have you. And so I do tend to always gravitate towards shoulder pads. Like that's a trend that I love because I love the way I look in it versus feeling really small and enclosed. This makes me feel really confident and big and, you know, I can do anything.
I love it. So I want to go back to this idea of self-expression because I think it is super important and something that was an important piece for me in my evolution with clothing, that I had to first get over this conditioning that said it was frivolous to spend money on clothing or that it was, you know, not a good use of funds. I had a lot of conditioning on this. And I had to really practice buying things that weren't practical. Mm. Okay. And that was so challenging for me. Like I had, and I still, you know, I still have a closet full of fabulous black shirts, but there's, you know, there's a whole section in the closet that's just black, right? But I used to buy black because it was practical and it went with everything and I wouldn't have to spend more money. And I think it was also a little bit of, for me, I'm not saying this is for everyone, a little bit of hiding. Like I didn't want to really be seen. And I had to, like, if you're on audio only, I'm in a bright gold colored, Yeah, thank you. I love this shirt. It's one of my favorites. Bright gold shirt, which I would have never, like in a million years, have picked pre this evolution, right? This would have been maybe too sexy, maybe too bright, maybe too flash. It has a little shine to it, right? I had all sorts of stories running through my head about what was okay and not okay. And okay, pulling back the curtains, Maggie, total transparency. We just, you know, a few months ago redid some of the branding for the website and put a new bio picture up. And the team picked this, if I do say so myself, kind of flip back my hair, like picture of me in a white dress that's very low cut and it's got a lot of boobage, right? It's
I cannot wait till this is over because this is the first thing I'm going to go to look up.
It might have been changed already. So I don't know. So like it's been, and I was like, I'm just going to let the team pick. I love that photo. It's a beautiful photo. It's very boobalicious. And I'm like, that's the fashionista in me. That's totally fine. That's like Vogue, right? Like you can walk down the street with, you know, a low cut shirt. But I'm like, is that, you know, so, but there's still a conversation in my head. Like, is that the photo that I want to put out there? And it's not that I think being sexy is anything wrong. I love that aspect of myself. But I was explaining it to someone on my team. She's like, tell me about this. I thought you loved this photo. And I was like, I do. But it's like, hey, look at me. Look at my boobs. And I don't want other women coming to the website and going, oh, she's like threatening me with her boobs. Does that make any sense? Do you know what I mean by that? Yeah.
I can't listen. I'm a woman in tech. Okay. I work in tech and I'm a woman. There is not very many of us. And I will go to conferences and listen, my true self is being dressed again, the way that makes me feel good, the way that makes me feel comfortable. Usually that means I am grossly overdressed at a tech conference where men show up with hoodies and, you know, whatever, regular slacks and sneakers. And so I have men all the time be like, oh, wow, like you're really dressed up. And I'm like, no, this is me. This is who I am. This makes me feel good. I am dressed the way I want to dress. And I constantly struggle with being like, am I overdressing for this event? Is this appropriate? Does this seem professional? But again, it's who I am. Why should I have to, you know, limit my true self because it makes other people feel uncomfortable?
Yeah. And do you ever?
No, I don't.
That's awesome. But you still have the conversation in your head.
Oh, I absolutely have it. And it usually ends in like, I don't care. I am who I am. Like, and it's not just tech conferences. It's even regular events that I go to. I'm always overdressed, more overdressed than anybody. And it's just who I am. That's my MO. I'm okay with it. People know that. They expect it. And I always say, I'm like, I'm on brand. This is on brand for me. And people are like, yeah, that is on brand for you.
I agree. I love this conversation because I just went to a few months ago, to a meeting with some friends of mine who are colleagues, and we met downstairs in the lobby to go out to dinner, and we're all giving each other hugs, and like three of them, one right after another, said, I wore this because you were going to be here, Amira. And it was like a sexy, kind of like a little sexy dress. Another one was saying, yeah, I put on a dress because of you, Amira. And I was like, oh my goodness, really? And because I haven't in the past retreated from it, it allowed them to feel comfortable and call up. So I think that's a really, you know, I talked about that photo on the website because I'm anything but in competition with you type woman. Like that's just not my MO, but it's a very editorial photo and it could be a little like there's some emotional distance from it, right? And if I'm that in person, you get the full package. You get the warmth, you get the exuberance.
And it's still so, image part to convey all of the other things that are not threatening, obviously, about you, right? But in a photo, then I get it.
I love it. Hey there. I just want to take a quick moment and ask, what's the thing holding you back from your own success? The hidden shadow or saboteur potentially at play for you And do you know how to find it? We often have that one thing keeping us from our next level. And it's not always the strategic move. It's often the internal one. I found in my own journey of success in building my exquisite life, it's what I call a core wound or loyalty pack. What's that? I share more at theunstoppablewoman.com, right on the homepage. Find out more at theunstoppablewoman.com. Now, let's get back to our episode. So let's talk about being in tech and fashion, that synergy. So tech crosses so many different worlds, right?
Yep.
Previously, you said you were in tech and SaaS, you know, in SaaS, and then you made the transition to starting your own business. In both cases, you're doing tech. I assume that in the latter, running your own business, you're also surrounded by a lot of creatives, a lot of people in fashion. So it's buffered a little bit. But how was it being a woman in tech before you started your own business? What were the challenges around? So I'm going to ask that question. What were the challenges around that? That said, I am not fishing for victim stories, right? That's not the vibe of the-
I'm going to give you victim stories, don't worry.
Yeah, you don't seem that way. But like, I'm just curious, like, what was that like? How did you approach it?
It's definitely challenging, I'll tell you. Interestingly enough, I didn't really feel a lot of it in my previous career. I mean, listen, you notice it. You sit in a boardroom and it's 80% men. You know, we employed probably 80% men because they were all developers. And at the time, software development was inundated with men. It now obviously has a lot more women in it, still disproportionately men. But I employed women, I employed men, I managed men, I didn't report into men, luckily, but my clients were all men. And so you feel it. But I didn't really feel it until I started this business. And I'll tell you why. Selling.
I wasn't expecting that, Maggie.
I didn't.
Okay, I'm very curious.
Selling software was fine. You could sell software. People needed it. It was a utility. They needed the software. They'll buy it. Great. Then I got to a point where I started this company and I needed to now go out and ask people for money. I have to fundraise. I'm a woman. I dress the way I dress, unapologetically so. I look the way I look, unapologetically so. I don't look like your typical tech CEO. So now I'm getting into, I want to say boardrooms, but it was all via Zoom. Now I'm getting into meetings with a bunch of men that know nothing about fashion, don't really care about retail. They invest in tech. They're usually investing in male CEOs. And I have to convince them that I created this shopping app that's going to change the world and they should give me a bunch of money. How do you think that went down?
I don't know. How did it go down?
Well, not very well. Eventually I raised, and I'm very fortunate that I raised because, you know, obviously 50% of entrepreneurs are women. Mm-hmm. 1% get funded.
How much did you raise?
I raised 10 million US.
Congratulations. That's fantastic. So the reason I asked, like, well, how did it go? I mean, you're uber competent, right? So I get that there might have been a few false starts on figuring out how to communicate the storyline, how to make it clear for people. But what did you ultimately have to do differently to communicate the value proposition to the investors?
So you're totally right. Obviously, in the beginning, and I didn't know what I was doing. I'd never fundraised before. This is my first time having to go out and raise money from other people. So you learn along the way. The first 10 meetings, very rough. Like, you're just figuring it out. They're asking you questions and you're like, oh, that's a good question. I should have an answer for that the next time I do this meeting. And so you build your answers as you go. So yes, there was a bit of that, but a few things. Fortunately, I started kind of seeking women investors. So females that could understand what I was trying to do. And then I was also very lucky. Our company had grown a ton. So we had a ton of momentum behind us. The industry was all like just clamoring to get into live shopping because it was the next big trend. So again, a little bit of luck on my end for sure. And then, as you said, I just became really confident and I was like, listen, this is my business. It's amazing. If you're not going to invest in it, somebody else will. I don't care. And ultimately, that's what you have to do. But that's who I am. And I'm kind of a hard person. If you're not, and a lot of women aren't, we're kind of conditioned to be soft and we're shy and we're not as confident and we second guess ourselves and we doubt ourselves and we don't think we're good enough. Like, just naturally, we really don't. It took a long time for me to get there. And especially if you're younger, I started my business a bit older in life. I was already an executive. I had already worked in a male dominated field. So I think I have a leg up on a lot of female entrepreneurs that maybe haven't been there. But if you're, you know, in your mid 20s, if I did this in my mid 20s, I don't think I would have been successful. I don't think I would have been able to raise the way I did, especially like maybe I could have, maybe a smaller round, maybe a worse valuation, what have you. But it took a long time for me to get here. And it's, I think part of the work that you're doing too is just helping women feel like they can and empowering them and letting them know that, you know, you're just as good, if not better than that man. You just, they're just really, really good at conveying it.
I think what's interesting about what you said is that you ultimately through persistence, discipline, right? Like reps, got good at this and figured it out. You also put yourself in front of the right audience. So that helped. But then you spoke about the confidence conversation in your head, right? Like that there was, you have to get over the self-doubt and the questioning, like, am I doing this right? Tell me a little bit more about that, because I'd like to like pull back the curtains on this. I think it's a really interesting conversation because, you know, I work with a lot of super high performers. Anyone looking in from the outside is like, oh, she's got her shit together. She can walk into any room and people take her seriously, right? And that might be true, but on the inside, there's questioning and there's doubt and there's wondering if they're doing the right thing and is this the direction? I end up being, you know, the trusted advisor sounding board for a lot of these conversations that are legitimate, thoughtful conversations to be having. I'm going to pause there. I have my own thoughts on this, but what do you think about the fact that that came up for you when you were doing this?
The first thing I think of when we're having this conversation is imposter syndrome. And I cannot tell you how real it is. And likely, you know better than I do because you're coaching these women. I'm just one single entrepreneur, but likely, I would say probably the majority of female entrepreneurs feel this. I mean, it happens with men too, and not just entrepreneurs, actually, executives. We've gone to this high place in our careers. We have earned it. We have worked twice as hard as men have, okay? We've really had to prove ourselves, and yet we still have this doubt inside us, like, did I earn that? Am I good enough? Can I do this? They gave me this promotion, but like, can I actually do the job? Of course you can do the job. It's this internal dialogue that we have with ourselves that is, I don't know if it's just like a preconditioned evolutionary thing where we just don't feel like we're good enough. I'm hoping that Gen Z is changing that narrative and I'm seeing a little bit of that, but it's just a sad reality, honestly, of being a strong, powerful woman. And it's something that we have to get really good at grappling with, whether that is you're doing your daily affirmations or whether you're having that internal dialogue before you go into a meeting or what have you, or just like, you know, sporadically throughout the day, you're like, you know what? I'm very good. I'm great at what I do. I've gotten to here because I deserve it. And, you know, I need to stop doubting myself.
Yes. Talking back to the doubt is a big one. Personally, I think, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why women do this a little bit more than men. It's not that men don't have self-doubt or the internal conversations, but there are a lot of biological, hormonal differences between the male brain and the female brain. This is not a better or worse. This is like, we are biologically different. Acknowledging that, I think there's a lot of use for this. If we don't demonize it, if we don't say, this is bad, I want it to go away, resist it, push on it. If we say, oh, this is actually part of my superpower is to be thoughtful and questioning and wondering, is this the right thing to do? Not to the point that you don't act, right? But to the point where you're making more insightful decisions.
There's like this sweet spot where you can use it for good, but if it goes too far, then it's kind of toxic. But if you do get that, like, okay, let me think about this one extra time, then I'm more thoughtful and considerate and what have you about my, and intentional. You're right. It's just finding that is tricky.
It is a sweet spot because if you look at your behavior and you cut yourself down to the point of being scared to act, right? Or limited in some fashion, that doesn't work. But if you look at your behavior with a critical eye that says, oh, I could have done that differently. I could have done that better, right? Like that pitch didn't go well. I need to do it like this, right? And you lean into that and you grow from it. That is a really useful version of the internal conversation. And I think there's gradations. Like, we do that in some places maybe and not in others. And, you know, if you can translate that, it's a really good thing. I want to go back to one thing that you said. You said, you know, we work twice as hard as men. And
controversial, sorry.
I know. Well, we have controversial.
That's what I'm here for. I wasn't here for like the soft talk. I'm here for the real talk.
Totally. Let's go there. So let's talk about that. Why do you believe that? Do you think it's actually true? And I will come out and say, I'm of two different minds here. Like, I run my own business. You're a CEO too. I have hired men who are like, don't work that hard. And I'm like, what planet are you on? But that can't be every man, right? Like, that's an obnoxious sexist thing to think, right? Like, Jeff Bezos worked pretty hard, you know, like, you know, so this doesn't translate. So why do you think you have, because the truth is there's some men that work really hard and some men that don't. There's some women that work really hard and some women that don't. Like, we can't make those generalizations. You and I both know that. But why do you have that impression? Like, why did that stick for you?
It's not that I don't think men work hard. But let me reframe that. I've employed men that work really hard. I've worked with men that work really hard. When I say we have to work twice as hard as men, I mean, this is not like, I'm not making this up. We get paid less than men do. We're less likely to get promoted. We're less likely to be in executive roles. This is all like searchable. Google it. I don't have to tell you the stats. I'm in tech. Like, somebody else will tell you that stat. So the reason I say we have to work twice as hard is in order to be seen as an equal to a man, we have to really outperform and really outshine them. These are just statistics. That's just what stats have told us. So that's not to say men don't work hard. They absolutely do. And even though we're 80% female staff, the men that I employ are incredible. I love them. And I've worked with like some of the best men that can exist. However, in order to have a woman in that same position, not at my company, but maybe at a bank, a woman has to work 2, 3, 4 times as hard to get there.
I've seen it
in my own eyes. They get looked over for promotions. They get, you know, because there's a man there that is able to shine a little bit better than she is. And maybe it's because he's more confident. There's 1,000 reasons for it. I don't think we can take that one statement, you know, on its own in isolation. I think there's a lot of other factors, but statistics will tell us that men tend to be favored when it comes to executive roles, higher salaries, promotions, et cetera.
I love that. Yeah, it's a really important piece to think about when we're looking at the big picture there. Going back to another thing that you mentioned, you talked about daily affirmations. Tell me about your daily affirmation practice.
I actually don't practice it. That's the best part. Or maybe I do, but not as consciously as I know some other people do. I have a lot of friends actually that will get in front of a mirror every day, and it's such a good practice. And they will stand there and they'll say, you know, I am beautiful. I am enough. I am confident. I am smart. I am what have you. I think I do that throughout the day as I go along. And I've been doing it sort of my whole life. It's just, you could call it like false confidence, but it's worked. So I don't practice it in the form that I think most people do, but I do find myself, as we kind of talked about, throughout the day, just having these little conversations with myself where I play squash. I love it. I'll be heading to a squash match. I'll be like, I am great. I had a great day. My life is going so well. Just getting myself pumped up for that thing. And though it's not in its like true proper form of affirmations, that's the way I kind of do it.
I love it. I think that's great. That's a conscious self-talk. So good on you for that.
I talk to myself all the time. It's a little crazy, but this.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. We all talk to ourselves all the time. Like, we have this inner voice. Okay. This is our default mode network. Okay. That's the neuroscience lingo for it. You might as well make a conscious choice about what you're saying to yourself.
And have nice conversations with yourself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So going from affirmations, let's go to visions. Like, what's your vision? Not your pitch deck to the investors, but like, what's your vision for Shop Thing? What's your vision for your life?
Not my pitch deck, but my vision really is I want to take over North America when it comes to live shopping. And again, that's like this blue sky thing where I'm like, I would love 100 million people using my app. For me, that is success. For me, it's when I know that I've been able to penetrate that many people. I've changed the way they shop. I've also changed the way they sell. We've actually launched this thing called Marketplace recently where we allow anybody to sell. Traditionally, it was like our curated influencers. Now we allow anybody to sell. So if you had something in your closet that you want to get rid of, you can host your own live shopping event. For me, why that's really important is there aren't a lot of gig economies that exist that are friendly for women. So if you think about it, women don't really feel safe hosting in their house like an Airbnb. Women don't really feel safe driving Ubers. Some of them do it. But again, you see a disproportionate number. I wanted to create a gig economy that women could feel safe doing. And women can feel safe selling things out of their closet or going to a store or what have you. Creating this side hustle that allows, whether you're a new mother or a single mother or you want a side hustle because you want to, you know, go on vacation or really just pay your rent, whatever that looks like. I wanted to be able to give women this alternative way to earn money that was safe for them. And for me, that's really, really, really important. If I can penetrate 100 million people, that means I'm also allowing a ton of women a really nice, safe way for them to earn a living. So that's my vision for the company. My vision for myself is, unfortunately, right now, I'm kind of there's a divergence between the vision for myself and my company. And until I can see that through, it's hard for me to even think about myself. Like, what makes me happy right now is being able to create this incredible company that can help other people, that will spread, you know, all of this goodness. And I feel like when I get there, then I'll be able to be happy. Obviously, I also have children who make me happy and there's fulfillment within my life as well. But when I think about my life's vision right now, it is how many women can I allow to have a safe way to have a side hustle?
I love that. I love that. I would just, and I think this is great. 100 million. Where are we at in comparison to that?
At 100 million.
What's the gap?
We're at about one. So we need to 100x the company.
Okay. Well, that's a nice big goal, right? That's like nothing like a huge challenging goal. And I want to go back to your vision and the gig economy and who uses this product and all of that. I want to dig into that. But you said something that was interesting that I'm just going to push you on. It might push your buttons. I don't know. You said, when I get there, I'll be happy. I don't know if I have that quote.
I knew you were gonna double click on that. I shouldn't have said that.
But this is the reason I'm harping on this is because I've been there. Okay. Like, I've set the goal and I've been so focused on the goal that I didn't care about the journey. And I made my life less optimal, less exquisite, less lit up, less magical than if I held that goal, but also was like lit up living an exquisite life as I was getting there. That's my gig, right? That's my thing.
I love that this has become free coaching for me.
I hope so. I love that, right? Like, because I really, your passion is this impact for the gig economy for women, right? Safeway. To do that, mine is like for, and maybe it's not as many women that fit this category, but for that uber achiever, that woman who's going for, you know, you have a big ass goal there, right? Like, you're going for something really big. Like, how do I help them achieve their goal? It's not about not achieving your goal. It's not about somehow like changing your drive and your ambition. It's about, how do you do that and have an exquisite life and feel like that delight and juiciness and lit up? So okay.
Something so interesting, like the goal is there, but the journey doesn't get appreciated or enjoyed. And I can tell you, truer words have never been spoken, because for us, it's like we hit that one milestone. Let's say it was fundraising. You fundraise. I mean, we enjoyed it. We went to Miami for like 2 days and had a fun time. But right away, it was like, okay, what's the next one? And what's the next one? Next one. And there's like, you have a milestone month. Great job, everybody. Get back to work. Now we have a next month has to be even bigger. Or the next year has to be even bigger. And it has to be. And I think some of that comes from the pressures of having external investors in my company. I'll be honest with you. I think if I was running my own company and I had unlimited funds to do so, it would be a different story. I'm a crazy person. So I'd still have those crazy goals and I would still probably glaze over half of our achievements. But I think it would be less, you know, we need this hyper growth, otherwise we can't survive. That's kind of with tech too.
Yeah. I'm going to say yes and no. Yes, I'm going to give you that. And no, that's how you were raised. That's how you were.
I was also raised like that. You're right. Yeah.
Okay. And that's, so and here's the thing. It works for a while. Okay. And we can motivate ourselves that way and we can go for it and it works. But then there's a point in your life where you wake up and you're like, where's the magical, exquisite life that I was dreaming of, that I was working so hard for? And I just want to get to women before they hit that phase. I'm fine working with them when they get there. But like if I can help them tweak things in earlier on, then maybe that landed just a little bit. It's not about not hitting your financial goals, though. You know, it's not an either or equation. Okay. Hey, Amira here. Want to know more about what keeps uber successful women from achieving everything they want in life? Find out more at theunstoppablewoman.com. Now let's get back to the episode. So let's go back to the gig economy and like, who's using your app? Like, who, there's the woman who is the influencer, and then there's the woman who is the fashionista who just wants to sell her things, right? Yeah. Tell me all the women. And then who's watching? Like, how do people know about this? Is it simply social media? Like, how is that happening?
Yeah, good question. So I'll start with the customer, because that's a really easy one. So our customer is, she's a woman. She's age 25 to 55, I would say, actually even older, because like my mother is one of our biggest customers and she's 70. And so really like big age range here. She values convenience. She doesn't really necessarily want to go to the store, or she doesn't like shopping online. She finds shopping online really daunting and really difficult. And she wants to have an actual human being explain things to her. And so that's our customer.
So many questions there. We'll get to the other side. Okay. So she wants someone to explain things to her and finds shopping online daunting. So why is shopping online daunting? Is it like, I don't know how that's going to look on me. Is that good for my shape? Is that the dauntingness to
it? It's everything. So part of it is that. Part of it is also, I don't know if you've ever been in this scenario where you're on an e-commerce site. There's 1,000, maybe more items. You just look at blue jeans and you're scrolling through like 500 static images of blue jeans. You add a bunch of things to your cart, but then at the end of the day, you're like, screw this, I'm out. It's just, I call it catalog fatigue. It's just too much. Okay. And it paralyzes people. And that's also why e-commerce cart abandonment is so high. It's just not, like when we think about e-com came about maybe 25, 30 years ago. There's been no evolution in online shopping for e-commerce since then. And so this is the new way. It bridges the gap between physical shopping and online shopping. And Amira, like if, let's say you were looking for something, instead of you spending hours upon hours going through a website, we are curating and telling you what to buy. We are saying, you know what, this is the trendy style in blouses, in pants, in shoes, in bags. You're having influencers tell you what to buy instead of, it's more like passive shopping versus active shopping.
So so my skeptic mind goes, well, they're making money on this. They're going to tell me to buy whatever they want to sell. So like, why should I trust them? Like, is it because I'll never buy something from them again if they don't, the ongoing credibility?
Good question. So our model is actually a little bit different. Our influencers don't get paid by a brand. They are curating, they get paid on commission, great, but they're curating selection based on what they love. And so what ends up happening is you'll find an influencer that really resonates with you. Maybe her body type is like yours, maybe her style is like yours, or there might be a few of them, and you follow them and you tend to buy more from that person, and you watch all their lives and you chat with them and you know that you're the same size as them. So if they put something on and they say, you know what, I'm usually a size 8, but I had to go a 10 in this because it's running small. You're like, okay, great. I know what size to buy. I do it. They're all my staff, but there are the ones that fit like me, body shape, and I love their style and I tend to buy from them. And even if they're a little bit smaller than me or a little bit bigger than me, I know how to adjust my size accordingly. If it's a little big on her, then it might fit me. Or if it's a little small on her, then it might fit me, what have you.
Okay. So that's fascinating. And then are you partnering with e-commerce sites? Like when you talked about that cart abandonment and like the 1,001 jeans that you could purchase, right, online. I was like, wow, like if I had an e-commerce site, I would want to employ a bunch of live shoppers to help customers understand what to buy. Are you doing things like that?
Yeah. So we partner with the brands themselves, brands, wholesalers, distributors, what have you, whoever would have an e-commerce site. And part of this marketplace that we've opened up to allow gig sellers, we're also allowing brands and retailers to sell their own. So yes, let's say you had a little boutique in Texas and you wanted to sell things out of your boutique, but your e-com isn't doing it. Maybe you don't have as much reach as we do. You now can hop on, host your own live shopping events, sell to our audience, try things on, all that fun stuff.
And are people finding you from social media mostly? So someone will go live on social media, someone will find it in their thread, and then they'll start looking for other people on your site kind of thing? Or
We have a very big following on social. We're close to 600,000 on Insta and 150 or so on TikTok. Most of our awareness comes from there and our acquisition. And so it'll be via reels, via ads, via Instagram stories, TikTok, what have you. People will come in, discover us, and then they'll download our app. Once you download our app, then you're in. And then you're like, okay, let me find the person that I love. Let me go through and figure out what's happening live today.
Okay. And the app, again, for people who want to find it, is Shop Thing. Is that correct?
Shop Thing, yeah. On the App Store, both App Stores, Google Play and iOS.
Okay, we'll put it in the show notes as well. Okay, that's really interesting. Okay, so then that was your customer side. Fill in the other side. So
on the other side, we have influencers that we work with. For us, mostly they are usually full-time employed, but we also have some part-timers that work with us. Their job, they're basically, you can think of them as personal stylists. Their job is to shop. They curate collections. They work with the brands and retailers that we have partnerships with. Sometimes they work with people that we don't even have partnerships with just because they love that brand. And they will curate a live event for you. So let's say as an example, it was prom season and we wanted to do dresses. One of our influencers would go to a retailer. She would pick out the 30, 40 dresses she loved. She would put them on. This is all in the live show. Tell you how it fits, tell you how it feels. You know, basically bring you a little bit of her style in that thing that we're looking for.
Okay, that sounds great. I'm totally in the weeds. I have to ask two questions that are totally in the weeds. So if you're doing this, how are you trying on everything and keeping the live feed going?
Such a good question.
How does that happen?
Yeah. We are actually a different kind of live. So I like to say that we're North American live. In the Asian model and the QVC model, I mean, QVC is not a tripod, but in the Asian model, they put up a tripod and there's a camera and it's live the whole time. And you're just like talking to your audience and people are interacting with you, what have you. Our model is short video clips. So think Instagram stories, think TikTok, everything happens in 30 to 60 second video clips. So what I'll do, really practically show you, is I'll put this on, I'll go stand in front of a mirror, I'll take a video and I'll show you what it looks like. I'll give you alternative photos, alternative videos, what have you. And then I hit publish and it's live. You can still chat with me, but while she's changing, while she's curating, you're not seeing what's happening.
Got it. So was that an innovation that you came up with?
Yeah. For us, because I had experience in building mobile apps for these massive companies, the take that we had was we want to make sure that this, whatever we're producing, the customer experience makes sense for a North American audience. North American audiences, one, don't have time for live streams. Like, do you have time in the middle of the day from 12 to 3 o'clock to sit and watch somebody in a full live? And they don't even like it. Like, we tend to scroll past Instagram lives. We scroll past TikTok lives. It just hasn't done as well here as it has in Asia. So when we launch this, we're like, all right, let's do short video clips. Let's do something that's different. Because that also means if I'm live at noon, my live show will still exist for 2 days. So you don't have to catch it at noon. You can catch it at night right before you go to bed. You can catch it the next morning, right? But, you know, as soon as you wake up. And we see a lot of that behavior where we're busy, we're working, we're moms, we're what have you. But as soon as, you know, I have some free time, I can be in the app and I can still access the live and I can still purchase.
Got it. Fascinating. Okay. I love it. Because that's you're right. I don't watch lives, you know? I was like, I'm not going to sit and watch a live stream. Like, that's just not me. Really but- not. Yeah. Okay. So people can do it at their own time and like any social media kind
Absolutely.
Of. Yeah.
Okay, so if you're on great. Your own time, there is this intersection between entertainment and commerce. We call it entertainers, where I have a lot of users that might not buy from me, but they watch every single event and they talk to me and I know them and we've become friends and you build this community, obviously, and they'll buy eventually, but they watch every single event. So it's also obviously very entertaining.
I love it. So good. So let's go back through up until now with this business. What has been, aside from the fundraising, we talked about that. What has been the most challenging aspect of getting this off the ground?
I would have traditionally said fundraising. Outside of fundraising, I will say as a CEO, and my first time as a CEO, I find that it's a very lonely journey. And so going into that, I didn't really expect it. I'd always managed people, but even managing people, you have a boss, you can go to your boss, and your boss is the person that is there for you when you need to vent or have you. As a CEO, you have nobody. Like, yeah. And I'm maybe it's because I'm this type of manager, but I'm the manager that is, you know, always confident, always strong, never wavering. This is our mission. This is our vision. This is our goal. If we have a bad month, if we have a bad whatever, nobody knows it. You will never know it. There's always a plan of action, what have you. Inside, I may be panicking, but my team will never know that I'm panicking or that I'm stressed. That's just the type of manager I am. And so when you're that person and you're a CEO and you don't have a boss and you have nobody to go to and you can't go to your board because like they're your board. I had to learn to build a network outside of work and a community outside of work of other entrepreneurs, other CEOs, other people that were in similar types of situations and positions where we could just kind of vent to each other and commiserate on things that might be stressing us out or blips that we've hit in the business or what have you. I didn't expect that to be so difficult, but I would say that was definitely a challenge early on.
I think that's such an important piece to bring forward. This is something that I hear all the time, the sort of lonely at the top concept, but I think people have a misunderstanding of it, that it can be lonely because you need to be, you have to have your game face on for your team. There's places where you can have more transparency, but that doesn't mean that you can't have support. Like we have a very boutique, very small program called the Exquisite, which is just that. It's like a small group of, you know, CEOs and they have each other and they're going through business stuff, but they're also going through life stuff and they're together. So I don't think that you have to stay limited, right? You don't have to stay lonely. So good on you for finding people. It's very important. It's part of, and it's where the brain trust comes from. There's so much to learn from other people and you shortcut some of these things if you can show up in your vulnerability, right? If you only show up with your
game. Very important. You're right. Yeah. Vulnerability is huge in those things. Because if you can't be vulnerable, then you're not, one, you're not getting what you want to out of that community. But then you're also not giving back to
you. Yeah. If you only come with your game face on, it's like you're losing the value of being present in there. Okay. So before I ask my final questions, where can people find you? Obviously, we talked about the app being Shop Thing on Google Play and iTunes.
You can also find us on social, on Instagram, we're at Shop Thing, on TikTok, we're at Shop Thing. We have a website, but nobody uses it. Just download our app.
Okay, sounds good. Okay, so what do you think, how would you describe an exquisite life?
For me, an exquisite life, if I were to put it into words, would be I feel fulfilled in my career. I feel like I've been able to achieve something and I've been able to make an impact. That's really important for me. You know, my children feel like they're fulfilled by whatever I've been able to give them. So less like me feeling happy by them, but them feeling happy by the parenting that I've been able to provide. Obviously, I have a happy relationship with my spouse is really important. I mean, I know we can't control this, but an exquisite life to me is everybody that I love is healthy and also living their exquisite life, which again, I know we can't control, but if this is a magic wand, that's what I love.
So if you were to take a moment to have a personal assessment there, like by your own definition of an exquisite life, where are you in relationship to that? Are you a 1 out of 10? Are you a 10 out of 10? Are you somewhere in the middle? Like how complete are you?
I think I'd say 5. Okay. I think there's still a lot of work to be done on the business side. And I also think my children are kind of young. So I don't know if I've screwed them up yet. Hopefully in a few years, they'll tell me, yay, you're the best mom ever. But I think as a mother, where there's, that's another area where so much self-doubt, What am I doing wrong constantly? So I think that piece, it will take some time. You want to see how they develop into young adults. And my relationship is great. My family right now is healthy, knock on wood. So from that perspective, I think it's good. But I think there's still work to be done on the business side and still work to be done on the kids.
If you were to give one piece of advice to a woman listening, your choice, life or business or both, what would you share?
So this is my quintessential advice that I always give. And my staff is so tired of hearing it, but I really wholly believe in it. If it was meant to be easy, somebody would have already done it. It's supposed to be hard. There are supposed to be obstacles. The true gems are the ones that can figure out how to get past those obstacles. And that's what makes what you're doing really special.
I love it. That's yummy. That's good. Thank you so much, Maggie, for being here. What a great conversation. I really enjoyed myself. I'm going to go download this app and check it out. I hope everyone listening really enjoyed this conversation as well, took a lot out of it in terms of both like the confidence that you need to have being a woman going forward, founding a company, doing startup work, being in tech, but also about like claiming your full self-expression and who you are in this world and loving that and not being afraid of full expression of self, however you do it. Today, we talked about fashion as the full self-expression. Maggie and I have that in common, but there's probably a lot of, I know that there are a lot of different ways to do that. So I would love to hear from you. What landed for you from this conversation? Please comment. Please tell me what you thought. What were your takeaways? Did we push your buttons on anything? Let us know. I read all the comments. I love reading the comments. It's fun for me and it gives me great insight. And please, if you have a moment, like this or give it a 5-star review. Any reviews you do on iTunes are super, super helpful for us or on Spotify. They help get the podcast out into more people's hands. So if you could do that, that would be amazing. I'd be incredibly grateful. And if you share it, all the better. Love that too. It really helps us get this message of it's totally possible to have an amazing business, be successful in the traditional definition of success, and have an exquisite life, all the things that you want in all the areas of your life, that it's totally possible for you to have both. And with that, I'm Amira Alvarez. I'm the founder and CEO of The Unstoppable Woman. And thank you so much for being here. I'll see you in the next episode. Most ambitious women I work with already have good lives, possibly even great. But there's often this one area that is fine as is, but not yet exquisite. And yet, when we unlock that one area, they access a whole new level. I want to personally invite you to book a complimentary call with me and discover what that unlock could do for you. These calls are for women who have done at least $1 million or more in their business or executive career and are ready for an exquisite life inside and out. You can book our conversation at theunstoppablewoman.com/connect.